Today in the second hour, you're going to hear part two of our nice visit with Dom Flemons, the American songster. Last year, 2018, Dom released Black Cowboys. We get into a lot of detail in the second portion of our interview. I hope you heard the first part. If not, go to Unreal Bluegrass. It'll pop up there very soon. You can listen to that. Black Cowboys is an amazing release from Dom. So much research and so much information, but that's kind of the way Dom is. One of my favorite artists, and talking to Dom is just, it's nonstop fascination. He's been on the show several times, and every time I learn more and more and more, and I'm more amazed at the research that he loves to do. You can just tell in his voice that he's having a blast, and the Black Cowboys on Smithsonian Folkways is a great recording. It's a typical Smithsonian Folkways release. Tons of information, all compiled by Dom as he put together this great collection of music about Black Cowboys. You're going to like it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass. There's so much to catch up on, Dom. There's so many things going on. And welcome back to Unreal Bluegrass.
Well, I'm so glad to be back speaking with you, Steve.
You must have so much material in your house that you gather for these projects. I don't know how you have room to walk around, because I can't imagine. Every place you go, I bet you take something with you.
Oh, boy, yeah, it's some musicians have vices in one way, but records and books are my vice. It's funny that this year the Country Music Hall of Fame, they nominated me to be a part of the class of 2018 for the American Currents exhibit, which was really an awesome honor to have, because I didn't necessarily try to make a country and western album per se, but they kind of just confirmed that I had made a country and western album, which was actually really, that was so wonderful, because I think back on my early influences on what I would think of as cowboy music. I think of people like Marty Robbins instantly, another Arizona native, yeah. Or any number of musicians. Roy Acuff, I did Lonesome Old River Blues,
and that's right.
That's a little great Crazy Tennessean number that I've always thought was a nice little blues number. So I was so glad to get Brian Farrow and Dante Pope to do some vocals on that. Jimbo Mathis and Alvin Youngblood Hart, I asked them if they'd like to be a part of the project, and they were big cowboy music fans as well, so we got to do a nice little session with Stu Cole on the bass. And there were just so many different aspects of the album that just knocked me out.
I can tell it's all still fresh in your mind, too.
Yeah, and with the Country Music Hall of Fame, it was I'd lost my train of thought on that anyway. But it's been a lot of really exciting. It's been a lot of exciting experiences of a lot of different aspects of the Western culture coming together.
Well, you were talking about having been nominated for a 2018, or at least put in some class, and then I may have distracted you along the way as you were talking about the honor of being in that, and I may have pulled you aside. I apologize.
Oh, that's all right. But now I remember, because you were talking about all the stuff in the house. And so when they asked me to send in some of the materials I had, I sent in about 350 items, books, records, ephemera. I sent them some big cow rib bones, one of my sets of ostrich toe boots, which they put on display.
Oh, no kidding.
There's an old Stetson that my father's father, my grandfather Raymond, owned, so they put that up. They had my copy of the Negro Cowboys in there as well. So I was able to give them a whole bunch of information, because to me, as well, since we're on Unreal Bluegrass, I should take some moment to mention that, one of the things that's so interesting musically about this phenomenon, because now this year there's been a lot of reverberations about country music and what does it mean for race and country music, and it's interesting because you have two different stories happening at once with African American country and western or old time music. You have one whole story that is interconnected between, especially the string band music. That's why I picked a song like Knox County Stomp, because I found that the story of the Tennessee Chocolate Trops and Louie Bluey, that type of string band music, really evokes a very elaborate history of westward migration, because we would think of the West as being all Western states, but, you know, Tennessee used to be the West, and mm-hmm. Arkansas used to be the West, and, of course, I mentioned Bass Reeves within the guise of Lightning Hopkins, and again, Lightning Hopkins has a very elaborate story, being from Houston, being a black cowboy, but also being a blues singer, and those two parts of the culture can go back and forth quite freely between one thing or the other. So it's been interesting being able to toe that line and be able to tell
I know what you're saying. It's important to be able to have that conversation. If it's in music, if we can have that conversation and keep it alive, because right now we need more discussion and free flow of ideas. My editorial, maybe you weren't going that way, but I think your music and what you're talking about all helps make that connection and make it realize that it's kind of the same. You know, the music is maybe the binding material. It doesn't have to be all the time, but certainly that's an example of the binding material between all those different kinds of music and different sounds. Someday I will tell you when I see you next, which hopefully won't be too long. I'll tell you the story of Petey Wheatstraw. He used to come to my great-grandparents' house down in Kentucky and eat a meal and play music with them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It is something.
Because they didn't...
Yeah, well, you know, that's one of the things that I think is very interesting as well in terms of it delving into this part of the history is that, you know, part of my goal has always been to push the history that would exist, whether it leans into the narrative people know or whether it doesn't lean into the narrative people know, because the black cowboys would seem to disappear if you were to look just into the history books of black cowboys. But if you start to think of it as being a continuous history that goes straight from one era to the next, and that it's a mobile culture that is then moving to a new urban center, it really tells a lot about the past 100 years of people, you know, persevering and finding it, planting new ground and being able to build a new life for themselves.
Yeah.
And that's something that I just think is very powerful. And Black Cowboys just happens to personify so much of that westward migration, not just for African Americans,
no.
but for, I think, any American, because the cowboy truly is one of the most iconic characters of American culture. And so for me, it was intriguing to be able to embrace this idea wholesale. But then, of course, you know, now to see it go out there, I'm so excited to see that cowboys are taking on a whole other level of interest again over the past year or so. And so I'm glad to be just at least one person that was putting that idea out there. I'll be interested to see where it continues to move and develop, you know.
Well, it'll come back to you, and maybe that second go-around will come back to your mind, and you can reset another framework for the music to be explored and listened to from all the people that have to be crazy about the first album. You have a website. Does it have tour information, how to get information? I assume I've looked it up. If you just type in Dom Flemons, you're going to find you, right?
Well, actually, nowadays I have a new website.
Okay.
I think since I spoke last, it's The American Songster.
Okay.
And just as in general, you know, when I developed the idea of The American Songster, and I explained it a little bit in the liner notes in The Black Cowboys, but the songster in the 19th century was a book of lyrics of all of the popular songs of the day. And then as the 20th century came in, you had songsters that were musicians, and they did the same thing, and they sang and played a variety of material for their audiences. And as the American Songster, that's one of the things I try to do, is I try to bring a variety of material and curate a narrative that can take people onto a different experience in a different plane when they're listening back to the recordings. Like, actually, you were mentioning the poems in Black Cowboys, the album. There's the poem Old Proc, and that was one that came from one of the legacy poets, Wally McCrae, from the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering. So a younger guy named Andy Hedges recited it the first year I was there. And from there, I heard that poem, and I was just blown away by the notion of of old Proc being this sort of this figure that was well respected in his community, and that the narrator was surprised to learn that he was actually a black man, and that it didn't matter to all the best, you know, cowboys in his community that he was a black man, and it wasn't even worth mentioning. And I loved that notion. So I called up Wally, and I got to chat with him a little bit and asked for his permission to use the poem. And so it was really a wonderful way to connect, because it's a semi-biographical poem that Wally wrote. And he told me a couple of interesting stories about meeting this fellow, Joe Proctor, who was actually a real black cowboy that was out in Wyoming.
Did you know, Dom, the real story of, or at least the alleged real story of the legend of the Lone Ranger? I mean, I would assume that you knew that before you got into this project.
Well, you know, with Bass Reeves, that was actually the way I found out about Bass Reeves, was that I heard he was the basis for the Lone Ranger. I had seen a book called Legends of the Old West, kind of a generic-looking book, and I started to flip through it, and I found the story of Bass Reeves, and so I decided to look him up just a little bit more, and I came across R. T. Burton's book, Black Gun, Silver Star, and yeah, Bass Reeves is a dynamic figure of the West. I mean, his story as a man born into slavery who had to run from the plantation because he had an altercation with his master. Basically, the master taught Bass how to play cards and poker, and one night eventually Bass got really good and he started beating the master at cards. And so as a last sort of desperate attempt to get his money back, the master put Bass's mother's and Bass's freedom up for collateral on one of the hands of cards. He tried to cheat Bass, and so Bass reached over and just knocked him out and realized that was a horrible idea. He actually escaped to the Cherokee Nation and lived on the Cherokee Nation for around 10 years. And there was a judge in the Indian Territory back in the early days in the Indian Territory named Isaac Parker, and he hired Bass Reeves as a deputy U.S. Marshal to work the Indian Territory and, you know, keep rustlers and people who were selling whiskey and stuff like that. And so Bass Reeves was this, he was a municipal policeman. So it was like halfway between a bounty hunter and a sheriff. And he brought 3,000 people to justice.
Jeez.
And he never received a bullet wound, they said. And he also did a lot of things like the Lone Ranger, like he used disguises and he used all these really clever tactics, had a white horse and all this stuff, you know.
That's amazing. Isn't it just amazing?
Yeah, and so, you know, when I decided to put Bass Reeves into the album, because there were some songs, like the old-time cowboy songs, that I wanted to bring into the album so that it could be familiar to people, like Home on the Range.
Yeah, sure.
Know that song.
Right.
But so for people like Bass Reeves, there wasn't a song dedicated to Bass Reeves, and to me, it instantly struck me that a Lightning Hopkins Boogie Woogie would be the way to do Bass Reeves. Because I think back on Les Blank's film, The Blues According to Lightning Hopkins, and there's a scene where Lightning is at an all-black rodeo, and he's just in the stands enjoying himself. And that image in my mind really just it got me thinking about the blues in East Texas and sort of the role of a lot of those early songsters when it came to them being the descendants of these black cowboys, and that the blues is a part of this world of black cowboys, musical interchange and interaction. And so that was one of the things that just struck me. It was like, oh yeah, let me get Bass Reeves to be like a Lightning Hopkins boogie, just like Steel Pony Blues. I wanted it to be sort of like a, I don't know, somewhere between like a John Hurt number or a Robert Wilkins song or something like that.
I'm not laughing. I'm smiling so hard. It might come off, but I just have this big grin because I know how you delve into these things, and it just makes me smile. If it sounds like I'm laughing, it's only because I'm smiling so hard.
Well, it's funny. It's funny because this is what Mike Seeger taught me specifically. Like, taking, you know, after a certain point, you know, because to me it's all about making compelling music. That's how, to me, I sidestep being traditional and authentic, is make compelling music, because that's kind of what draws you in. If you hear something that's compelling, you're drawn into it and you want to hear it again and again, and that's how all of us get into music, you know. And with Mike, I just remember talking with him about it, and he said that after a certain point, he learned all these different traditional styles of music, and then he just felt like he could mix and match them and kind of create a, almost like a quilt work pattern sort of style based off of different musical ideas he'd either heard about or things he thought made sense when placed together. And that's something that has always driven my music, is after spending a lot of time with Mike, I was able to start being able to figure out ways to make composite material that would be equally intriguing for someone who wanted the authentic stuff, but it would also be intriguing for someone who knows nothing about it or who isn't necessarily particular about how authentic it sounds, you know? So it gives me a lot of space. And of course, when it comes to original material, I like doing that too. I'd rather have I like writing the lost record of somebody, you know, and that's kind of my own interest. Songwriting.
This is all the stuff that I've missed about not talking to you, Dom, and that's why I'm so tickled to get you back on the program. And I love hearing you talk about the enthusiasm that you have even after this project. Do you have something in the works or some other project? We could talk forever, folks. I have to tell you this, that we talked long enough before we got started that I felt like I was abusing Dom's time for the evening. But is there something else that they're going to be looking forward to on the books that you're thinking of?
Well, you know, I'm starting to think about the next project, so that's something that we should all keep an eye out for at some point. I haven't quite got it in writing yet to figure out how I'm going to go about it or anything like that, but I've got some really great ideas coming along in terms of recording. But the thing that I actually worked on recently, I got to collaborate with two great record collectors and scholars, Dick Spotswood and Hank Sapoznik, on a project that's coming out on JSP Records, and it's called Protobilly.
I've got it. Hank sent it to me. I'm getting into that. I'm getting into that. But go ahead and speak about it.
Oh, wonderful. Well, you know, I was brought into it to kind of to co-collaborate on the liner notes, and so I wrote in an introduction as well as a. I worked on some of the biographies of some of, especially the early vaudevillians, because there's a lot of history that connects within pre-Broadway history, and that's something that really is a part of my scholarship that I don't talk about often. But it's very interesting to see the way that ways they connect into the rural Southern music that we would now think of as being different parts of old-time music or blues or everything like that. And I just found that this project, as the intro says, Welcome to the Time Warp, it really takes you into this space where the use of certain songs and certain materials and motifs sort of take you on this sort of kaleidoscope journey based on whichever performer is doing the song. Like one of the ones that I really think is just in a magnificent number is the Steamboat Boogie from the Delmore Brothers. And after having the cylinder of Arthur Collins singing Steamboat Bill, followed by Earl McDonald's original Louisville Jug Band doing a jug band version of Steamboat Bill, you're then followed by this real, like, very heavy boogie-woogie-based Steamboat Bill from the Delmore Brothers. And it's just a great juxtaposition. And of course, you know, Steamboat Bill is the song that Mickey Mouse sang in the Steamboat Willie.
That's right. I knew you were getting there. I knew you were going to get there.
And you know, and when I think about stuff like that, I think of the Louisville Jug Band. I always wonder, is Memphis Minnie the same as Minnie Mouse? But I don't, you know, you just never.
I never made that extrapolation. But that's something that you might need an album on that, Dom.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Memphis huge. Blues at that time is so huge at that time. Like it, but again, if you juxtapose all these different performers doing the same songs, it all of a sudden it makes the song mean a whole bunch of different things at one time. So it's a beautiful kaleidoscope. Also, another one's like Darlin' Nellie Gray. and a beautiful version that Louis Armstrong and the Mills Brothers recorded. That is a really hip jazz version as compared to one of the other Nellie Grays that comes from the Cylinder era, where you get to hear a juxtaposition of jazz coming in and embellishing on top of these melodies compared to the really straight-ahead version of the melody. Another one is The Dream of the Miner's Child.
Yeah.
They got the great Keith Whiteley version with the Stanley Brothers Band, but it's juxtaposed next to this really stiff early version of Don't Go Down in the Mine, Dad, which is the sheet music version. And, of course, if you look at the liner notes, you get a sense of what the sheet music looks like and the original context for the music within either its singular vaudeville performance form or in the context of a much bigger play, which is the case of a song like Pull the Woodpile Down,
which
the fellow who wrote the song, I think his name was Hardigan and Hart, were one of the very first, they were a predecessor to Rodgers and Hammerstein, and they set up the two-man songwriting duo for Broadway. But he broke off from his partner and then did this play called Pete, which Haul the Woodpile Down is part of this musical called Pete. And we have a version of Charles Asbury, who recorded it in 1897, about 5 years after this play came out. And it's juxtaposed next to Uncle Dave Macon doing it with the Fruit Jar Drinkers. And so just juxtaposing the ways that they change the lyrics and change the context of the song is even fascinating. So it's a project that really it spirals out into these beautiful places that I think anybody who's into roots music is just going to go just crazy for some of the ways that it juxtaposes.
And see, now you've helped do my research, because I'm going to talk to Hank about that when I'm through it enough to where I can be fluid. Now you've helped shortcut me a lot of things. So we're going to talk about that whole collaboration. He sent it to me. I said, I need to have this right now, Henry, and he did send it to me. So I've got it. I've been listening to it.
Oh, nice. Well, it's such a neat set, and some of the stories are very telling, like a song like Bully of the Town. When I began to see in the research that I read from Hank that Bully of the Town was written from the same people that worked for William Randolph Hearst that also started Yellow Journalism, a song like The Bully of the Town now has a very specific place in my mind of what the imagery and the lyrics that are, can be, you know, they're still quite offensive to people's ears now.
Yeah,
it places it in a time and place that is the same as when I think of Jack Johnson or somebody like that, how they depicted Jack Johnson in the media during the same era.
You're right.
It's very indicative of the time, instead of it being just a general, it's not just a general type of racism that is just, you know, you find out that people were offended by it at the time, too. It's not just that everybody accepted it, but that there was pushback to much of this material that over time, of course, 20 years later, you find people clean up the material so that it is acceptable for its time and place, and it's it has a different connotation completely. You know, it really tells a lot.
Tom Flemings, you tell a lot, man. That's why I like you so much, and I always feel comfortable because I never was sure where we're going to go, but we're going to get someplace, and we're going to dig up a lot of neat information, and I just enjoy your time and your presence and your effort, and I know you're going to keep doing that. In the future, it's been a long time, but I saw you first not long after the Chocolate Drops were put together, and you've done nothing but pursue your desires and enlarge upon everything that you've learned in the process. You're not just giving back things that you knew during those days. You're learning more and bringing it back to people. And Black Cowboys is a great example of that, as you've just explained so well.
Well, thank you so much, Steve. Again, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, man. Talk again soon.
Yeah, we will. It's not going to be as long as it was, I guarantee it. And Don Flemings, I'm going to tell this real quick. If the listeners out there have watched the country music thing with Ken Burns, the last guy that catches the banjo before as the opening starts is Don Flemings. So you may not think you've ever seen him, but you have.
Yeah, man. Well, that's been a beautiful thing. Well, I've been so glad that I can be a part of be a part of the PBS lineup, you know?
It's a great place for you. Listen, I'm going to let you go. I know you're busy, and I appreciate it so much. I can't wait to see you performing again.
Awesome, Steve. Well, we'll catch you then.
All right, brother Steve. Bye.